I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A crafty way to tell one story is, or perhaps engage in some political pontification in a unique and equally subversive ways through textiles. The new book from Leanne Prain is a wonderfully colorful, fascinating, and expressive way some artists have taken to creating art, entitled Strange Material, Storytelling Through Textiles. We meet artists from around the world who are using needles, ink, and cloth to weave their own pieces of art. Ms. Prain joins me now, and I'll get her to tell us about this book, the people she profiles in it, and the sort of craftiness that she practices. Leanne Prain is a graduate of both the University of British Columbia and Simon Fraser University. She is a member of the Society of Graphic Designers of Canada and the Writers Union of Canada. Her previous books include Hoopla, The Art of Unexpected Embroidery, and Yarn Bombing, The Art of Crochet and Knit Graffiti, which she co-authored with Mandy Moore. LeannePrain.com is the website for more. The book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Leanne Prain will be participating in the Radical Reading Series as part of Canzine Vancouver. That's Saturday, the 8th of November, 2014. That's at 5 p.m. at SFU Vancouver. Visit brokenpencil.com/canzine-vancouver for more information. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Leanne Prain. Ms. Prain, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What is craftivism?
Craftivism is the combination of craft and activism. So I was recently on a book tour with Betsy Greer, who coined the term craftivism. And she has this wonderful chart that she's made up recently, which is, it's anything that's made by hand. So she's a list of things that are made by hand. So whether that's woodworking, sewing, knitting, crocheting, collage, and made for, and pretty much made for anyone. So whether it's made for your community, a police officer, a hero, a politician you don't like, it's the act of basically expressing yourself through the act of something handmade.
And quilting, I guess that falls in that, right?
Definitely, yes.
I guess the most prominent quilt that I can think of in recent years was the AIDS Memorial quilt.
Exactly. That was a quilt that I actually mentioned in my book.
Yeah.
It was sort of something that people really rallied around. And when AIDS and HIV was something that was very difficult for families to talk about, it was a way of, I think, putting emotions and stories into something that was handmade and making it visible. And allowing people to express themselves, even if they weren't ready to put what they were expressing into words.
Yeah, so it does happen quite a bit where people use textiles to say something. I mean, I guess have we just not noticed it, or is it really just sort of burgeoned in recent years?
I think it's definitely becoming more noticeable. I think it's something that's always existed. I have a couple historical examples in my book. One, there's a famous quilt. It's a Kentucky graveyard quilt, and it was made by a woman who was crossing America when the states was being founded. And it's almost a diarization done through quilting. So what this woman did was she created this quilt that had a graveyard in the center, and she made coffins for individual family members that outline on the border. And as they passed away, she would unpick the coffins and put them in the center of the quilts on the graveyard. And a lot of people have sort of gone back to that quilt. But as you sort of start to dig through historical research, stories, I think, have always been prevalent through textiles, because textiles have always been part of our lives and people have always been making things. But I definitely think the internet has magnified that for us. It's encouraged people maybe to try things with handmaking they wouldn't have done in the past. And I really love bringing these kind of stories to audiences that would never normally think of craft as a storytelling medium or as an activist medium. I love sort of playing that line of bringing attention to something that a lot of us don't know a lot about or choose to ignore.
Well, what is it about knitting in particular? Because I see a lot of people on the bus or the SkyTrain knitting now. You can go to bars and see groups knit together there. I mean, what accounts for the rise in that?
Well, I think a couple things have happened. I mean, one, knitting's incredibly portable, and it's one of those crafts that's very easy to take out on public transit. Say you can't exactly do that with a sewing machine. And part of, I think, the internet just growing, there's huge communities online. Knitters are one of the first groups that really took to the internet in the forms of blogs and online networks. There's a huge one that's called Facebook for Knitters called Ravelry. So it's sort of a place to teach each other skills through YouTube and show patterns and sort of take the offline world into the real world, if that makes sense. Like, there's a lot of people who do that at Exchange. I also think we've devalued a lot of things just because we live in a world where things are commodified. So our knitting, you know, comes in sweaters in the form of the Gap. Like, we no longer rely on our relatives to either make us a sweater or teach us how to make a sweater. And I think a lot of people want to reclaim those things. We spend all these times touching smartphones and screens and things that are plastic, and we don't spend a lot of time enjoying the tactile world. Mm-hmm. And knitting is a good sort of introduction to that.
Now, you dedicate the book to Connie and Don Prain. I'm assuming that they're related to you. Is that right?
Yes, those are my parents.
And so they always made things by hand. Is that correct?
They have. My dad's a carpenter, woodworker, boat builder. He's built a lot of Chinese junks. He's building antique cars. My mother always did a lot of embroidery and sewing. I didn't learn how to knit from her, but I learned a lot of other handcrafts from my mother.
So this was instilled in you from an early age, was it?
It was.
Yeah.
I grew up in rural Vancouver Island, so as a teenager, if I wanted the clothes that I wanted out of magazines, I had to learn how to make them, which was sort of a good introduction to figuring out how to make things and having it be accessible and not something to be scared of, which is, I think, why a lot of people don't start.
So I mean, did you see us as a culture, as a society, moving towards that? I mean, not necessarily being an activist, but, say, knitting your own scarf for the winter or patching, say, a pair of wool gloves that you have yourself rather than, you know, ordering a new pair online.
I think so. I mean, I think we're all at this point now where we all have so much of the same. I mean, there's I just picked up a magazine at the grocery store that talks about how much stuff we throw away, and I think we're all becoming much more conscious of that. And when you make something handmade, typically it's better than when it comes from a factory. It's also yours. Like, you've made something that nobody else can make because you can follow even a pattern, but we all have our own quirks of the way we put things together. I was just traveling. I've been on a book tour, and I've been to 12 different cities in the last 2.5 weeks, and as unique as all these cities are, you know, the stores are the same and the people dress the same, and it kind of, and now that we sort of have that online connection where we know what somebody's doing across the world, I think we're all looking for uniqueness, and making things by hand and returning to that is a really good way to get back to our regional roots now that we're so connected.
Yeah. Does one have to be, let's say, artistic or have great dexterity to knit or crochet?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think what I always think is you shouldn't learn from a relative. You should probably learn from a friend or a stranger.
Hmm.
And part of the reason that's come about for me is because some people are perfectionists and have rules. And I think traditionally with handicraft, there's always this thing, is there's the perfect way to make things. And if you allow yourself to make mistakes, you can either invent your own techniques or find out what works for you. I'm left-handed, so I had a really hard time learning from right-handed people. But once I sort of picked it up and tested things out, learning to knit was actually quite an easy thing for me, but I needed to make up my own rules to be able to do it.
So what's the difference between crocheting and knitting? Because I've seen people do both, and like, I've asked them what they're doing, and they've said, yeah, I'm crocheting, and then one says they're knitting. But to me, it looks the same.
Okay, so, knitting is done with two sticks, and crochet is done with a hook, so typically one hook. And knitting is typically done fairly flat. So if you make a sweater, it's done in flat pieces and seamed together. Crochet, the techniques that are used with crochet, which is making a chain and then hooking stitches into a chain, where knitting, you sort of go back and forth. Crochet is much more sculptural. So your stitches can go in any direction, which is why you see a lot of crocheted children's toys and things that have a sculptural element to them.
Hmm.
And there are sort of groups of knitters and crocheters that would not pick up one or the other. So crocheters have always said that crochet doesn't get enough attention. So there's sort of this crochet pride within the crochet group.
What do you do in terms of, say, your own, in your day, what do you practice?
I do knit, and I knit often. I don't knit every day, but I knit when I have some time to do it, and I'm in the headspace to do it. I've sewed. So I enjoy doing that. I do stitch work. So I do a little bit of everything. I really love doing community projects as well. So one thing I did last year at Vancouver Mini Maker Fair is I had a community embroidery project, and we made a huge table size embroidery, and anybody who wanted to stitch could come up and do that. So I really enjoy working with people in stitch work as well. That project was inspired by a woman whose name is Liz Kunike, who's been doing a project in cities around the world. And what Liz does is she takes city maps and she'll embroider them for the city that she's in, whether it's New York or Barcelona, and then she'll ask people to come up and add their own mark to her map. And she asks them to come up with a symbol that relates to the map. So she'll give them a legend, like, where was it? Where's a bad place in the city? Where's a place you fell in love? Where do you live? And in the process of adding onto the map, people often have conversations with strangers around them who are stitching. And she says this project helps conjure more conversations about the city. Like some of the things that we hold as beliefs, like, that's a bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
Somebody else might say, I live in that neighborhood. That's not a bad neighborhood. That's a place I fell in love. So I really love the idea that making things together can generate conversations that may not normally spark between strangers in everyday life.
So there are a lot of fascinating people in this book, Strange Material. Why did you choose to write about, first of all, why did you choose to write the book? And then, and where did you find the people that you talked to in the course of it?
Well, I chose to write the book because I think it's the book I always wanted to write. and part of that is I'd written two previous books on textiles that bordered on the political. But part of the thing that always sort of bothered me when I was studying as a student, I studied art history and creative writing, is that within studying art history as an undergraduate student and working in an art gallery and working in community arts council, were always messages about what was high and low art and what was worthy and what was not worthy. And as I started to interview artists from my other books, a lot of people had these amazing stories about their work and their life that maybe didn't always have to do with the visual end product, but it was how they got there, or something they felt important about their work that they thought was a side story to the work that they were making. And with the writing training that I did, I couldn't help but see, you know, what they were putting into those pieces. So I wanted to be able to tease out narratives and poetry and memoir from these textile pieces these artists were talking to me about. So that's sort of how I came about that. And how the artist came to me was really organic. I sort of have this catalog in my head of people I wanted to talk to for years. Projects just sort of lingered in my head. And as you talk to one artist, they'll always recommend three or four artists more that you should speak to.
Yeah.
So most of the artists I haven't met face-to-face. A lot of my interviews are done through Skype or the internet. So that is one thing that's been wonderful for writing, is that really led me to do global traveling.
Yeah.
The people I may not have met in person. On my book tour last week, I got to meet several of the artists in New York, and I've known them online for years, but it was the first time meeting face-to-face, and I felt close enough that I already knew them by the time we met in person.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things is we think of, say, knitting or working with fabric as one does, sort of old-fashioned or perhaps quaint, are hearkening back to a previous era. But at the same time, you can use the internet to learn different methods and meet different people, as you have. Pretty inspiring people.
Exactly, yeah. And even to get to know about projects I might not normally have access to as well. There's two artists, Nema and Alexia, who have a spoken word duo called Climbing Poetry. And when I interviewed them, they said, well, we're not textile artists. And I said, but you're doing this textile project.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been making these story flakes. So when they have a show, what they'll do is they'll put scraps of cloth on all the audience members' seats who've gone to go see a spoken word performance. And they'll ask people to put something that's going on in their lives on the scrap of paper, or pardon me, not paper, cloth, using a Sharpie. And then they'll collect all these squares and they'll stitch them together. And they've been doing this project for 10 years, and they're saying it's a way of collecting voices of people who don't normally speak, which has influenced their word as spoken word artists. So, and then they hang them in spaces where they do workshops, and they say they create sort of soft space with all these colored hanging flags. And part of these flags now, they're joking that they're becoming a new American flag because they're getting messages that's influencing their work that they couldn't pick up from regular news media. So I find that fascinating. And if I'd gone just to a textile museum to look for people like them, I wouldn't have found them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some nice synergies that way with the internet, too.
One artist in the book says that art is communication. Do you get a sense of what can be said in craft knit large that couldn't be said, say, in another art form or another form of communication?
I would think so. I mean, I think there's Mark Newport's in my book, and people are always asking, well, is this primarily something that women do? And, I mean, I think it's something primarily women have always done,
mm-hmm.
and we tend to learn the skills because we're placed in situations where we learn the skills. But Mark Newport's a knitting artist who creates suits that look like superhero suits. So they sort of resemble, they might look like Batman or Spider-Man, but they're a little bit unrecognizable. You can't tell which superhero they are, and they have long legs and long arms. And he's working as a male artist and commenting on masculinity and what it means to be a man today. And he knits these enormous three-dimensional suits that no man could probably fit into. They wouldn't fit your body correctly. And I can't see Mark's work in any other form but the knitted suit.
Yeah. And do you find, you've touched on this earlier, as to how the art community reacts to all of this. I mean, it's really part of that debate as to what is high and low art.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that museums, art galleries, have an appreciation for all this or not?
I think that really depends on the gallery and curators. So, I mean, one thing that I think... knitting, crochet, textile work still isn't seen the same way we view sculptures or painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think some of that attitude does come through the history of gender, and also what we consider important, what we consider functional and utilitarian, versus what we consider an art medium. And I think that I'm hoping that's changing, but I've yet to see it really taken up by galleries and art spaces. They still sort of look at textiles as simply community work, and therefore community work's unvalued of being at the level of art, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
With this book, I really wanted to focus on artists from all backgrounds. So I do have people that are exhibiting artists who only show in art galleries, like Freddie Robbins, Mark Newport, and then I have people who really have just been stitching home, at their home and not showing anyone their work and posting the odd thing on a blog or Flickr. And I really like that juxtaposition of voices and visuals. And I'd like to see more of that, not just in the textile world, but in the art world in general, because I think we miss a lot when we only pay attention to who's had shows and who has a CV.
So you are hopeful that after this book, people will take it seriously or view it more importantly, say?
I think so. I'm also hoping one of the things I wrote about in my introduction to this book is this is not... the only textile book that comes out on stories and stories mm-hmm. and textiles. I think we have a lot of digging up of history to do. There's a lot still to be written in the field, so I'm hoping this book is one of many. So there's still not a lot of people in Canada writing on textiles. There's Sylvia Olson, who's done a history of the Cowichan sweater. And there's my books, but I've yet to see other books on textiles coming out of Canada as well. Even though I focus on international subject matter, it strikes me as very weird that there's not a lot of other people doing this.
Now, if you wanted to attempt something, the book also has instructions, patterns and the sort, I guess, that one can follow along. And they're easy enough, aren't they?
They are. I mean, there's a huge variety of patterns. So there's 8, but they exist everything from fabric bleaching to knitting a sweater if you're a knitter, to some simple prompts. My idea in this was that not only would you learn about what the artists were doing, that you would be empowered to do your own work.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a writer, I'm hoping that maybe you'll do a textile project if you've never tried one for the first time. And if you're somebody who's really into textiles, you may experiment with bringing new conceptual ideas to your work. So I kind of wanted it to work back and forth that way.
And if you wanted to say, embroider something with poetry or a quote from a book, you have to be careful that it's because a lot of these things are copyrighted, you'd prefer your own work, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. I always think it's great for somebody to come up with something of their own or something that a relative has said to them or if it's a piece of poetry that really resonates, maybe it is made, but it's only made for their own use. Not for viewing outside the home.
Yeah, so. You've made poetry scarves?
I have, yes. Yeah. I actually collaborated with Laura Farina, who has a new book coming out with Mansfield Press, and we did a scarf that we bleached with Laura's words. And I really love that because Laura is a fantastic poet. We actually have a writer's group together. And I love the idea of being able to take Laura's poetry outside and wearing it and not having it something that's just stuck in a book. So,
you mentioned that you were on tour the last couple weeks or so.
Yes.
It took you to 12 cities, you said, right?
Nine cities, 12 events. I keep skewing that in my mind.
I see, yeah. So you went all over the states and the sort, right?
We did. We started in Oakland and San Francisco. And we ended up, our very last event was at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. So we were everywhere from co-working spaces, teaching workshops, to museum galleries, Textile Museum of Canada, which is in Toronto, to Hot Art City, which is here in Vancouver.
And in Vancouver, when you go around the city, you are finding people who are like you, who are engaged in this sort of activity?
Definitely. I think there's a good showing of craftspeople in Vancouver who are doing a wide variety of things. Everybody from the BC Crafts Council, which is doing some remarkable programming, the Artisans in Gravel Island, to we've got some really fun alternative crafters that got craft.
Yeah, it really is just a fascinating... I mean, I'm not artistic at all, so I don't think I'd be able to do something of my own. Nor am I have the dexterity to, or the patience even to do it, but it's just fascinating to see how many people do it and why they do it, because I think that's the important thing, is that there is, it's not just because, you know, they want a sweater or a scarf for the winter time. They have something to say.
Exactly, and I also think it's interesting to ask people why they make things,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the other reasons these books came about for me. It wasn't just like, oh, that's a nice sweater, how did you make that, which is, I think, what we ask a lot. It was like, why did you make that? And I find the more I ask why, the more interesting things I hear back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure a question that you get asked a lot is, where did you buy that? Do you get that?
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. We just assume that it's easy to buy.
Exactly, or I've always been somebody who's done a lot of thrift shopping, so I always love to say, oh, I thrifted this, and I only paid 50 cents for it. But even that becomes a certain kind of commodification after a while, too, which is why I really love enjoying getting back to handmaking. And now people are also upcycling materials, so they'll be reusing wool or reusing fabric. A good friend of mine is involved with an organization here in Vancouver called Our Social Fabric. And what they do is they take cast-off fabric from other sewers or fashion designers, and they resell it for a very low price. They have these monthly sales. So the idea is you're not just making a garment, but then you're reusing something that has already been cast off from somebody else's use, which I really love.
So people, because you mentioned a number of organizations, a number of people that you've met along the way, a lot of them are in the book, and then I guess they can get information on them off of your website, right?
That's right. So I've tried to include web links to all the artists in the book, but I'm also blogging and tweeting regularly about everybody in the book and new people as I meet them.
This has been quite fascinating for me, even though I'm not someone who would probably do this. But nonetheless, very, very interesting work. This is also a very good-looking book. So congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it, Leanne.
Great. Thank you very much.
The website for more, leannepraine.com. The book is called Strange Material: Storytelling Through Textiles. Arsenal Pulp Press is its publisher. Its author is Leanne Prain, and she joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.